interruption, but I'm Mike Wolf. On just a few more days until Christmas, Tone. You've been naughty or nice?
I'm Tony Kornheiser. I've been Jewish.
Let me sort of ask this one more time.
Right.
Naughty or nice?
It doesn't really matter, does it? If
sure.
I've been naughty or nice?
Sure, because you never know what other presents you might get or be denied.
I've been nice. I've been really, really nice.
Something from Perkins.
You
could come
have
away.
Been naughty. You. There are pictures of you.
It's the Banal of America Audio Holiday Special featuring Stanton Friedman.
Happy holidays.
It's the one night of the year when we all act a little nicer, we smile a little easier, we share a little more. For a couple of hours out of the whole year, we are the people that we always hoped we would be. Have a Merry Christmas, everybody.
Jim V wants to know if you can envision a peaceful, orderly disclosure event. It's hard to imagine our government voluntarily disclosing the ongoing presence of extra humans or extraterrestrials without incurring a public backlash that could easily escalate to violence. Even in a forced disclosure scenario, such as, you know, the aliens caused it on their own, how could we believe the government was finally coming clean after so much misdirection and deception? Would there be a parade of world governments saying, yes, we knew all along?
Well, the scenario I've envisioned in the past has been, how about if two highly trusted individuals around the world were to make a public pronouncement? My favorite choice would be the Pope and the Queen. And they're about the same age. It's not such an odd couple after all.
Well, the Pope's on Twitter now, so it's possible.
Okay, we're moving in the right direction. I was shocked just a couple of years ago when he said, well, there's no reason God couldn't have made our brethren in outer space, just as he made us. And my first thought was, who told him something?
And then quickly, someone got the Queen on the line.
What I'm saying is that the release has to be made sensibly. And that's why I picked sort of two neutral people.
Right.
And they would have to say that we have been reliably informed that the planet has been being visited, and that there will be a number of conferences held in the next 6 months with representatives from many different countries reviewing the implications of this from an economics, a religious, you know, all kinds of viewpoints, psychological. In other words, in an orderly fashion, not dump everything out there to begin with. And you don't need, I mean, the important thing is we're not alone. Not whether we can duplicate their craft, because obviously we can't yet.
Right.
So I think it would be a time for international cooperation. And the thing that people want to forget, especially Americans, and I'm a dual citizen in the United States and Canada, we're at the opposite ends population-wise. Canada's got about 35 million people, the U.S. 310. But
wow.
China has 1.3 billion people. India has a billion people. So the real question is, who speaks for planet Earth? Who can negotiate landing rights, you know, sales possibilities for alien goods? You don't say one person, one vote. No American government would agree to that. You know, so there are some practical problems that need serious attention. Without giving out the details. Mm. It's a major event, of course. But you don't need to put it in such a frame that everybody wants to run out and buy a gun to keep themselves from being abducted by those nasty aliens.
Exactly. Okay. Roger V wants to know, do you allow for the possibility that some so-called ET phenomena may be other dimensional reality interlopers as opposed to physical beings from other planets in our galaxy?
Well, I won't rule out that possibility. I see no reason to say it's true. Isn't it startling enough that we're dealing with real aliens, so to speak? I don't rule out much, but let's go with what we know. You know, and take it from there. That's a big enough story in itself.
Right.
And incidentally, I mentioned religion before. I still strongly recommend Dr. Barry Downing's book, The Bible and Flying Saucers. He's got a unique background, bachelor's of physics and doctor of divinity. Who else studies divine physics, you know? And he looks at the Old and the New Testament in a very sensible, rational kind of way. And we mentioned before about, you know, ancient astronauts and all that sort of stuff. Well, it's clear that for thousands of years there have been beings coming here. Now, that would only be shocking if you went along the Pat Robertson trail. The world was created in 4004 B.C., and, you know, on a Sunday, I think it was a Sunday afternoon in October. Anyway. Well, that is a very different view when it was 4 billion in 4 B.C.
Yeah.
So, I think we need to look at us. Well, I'm reminded that the Brookings Institute study said one of the groups that would be most affected by disclosure would be the scientific community, whose status would certainly be strongly challenged. They're not at the top of the heap anymore. My goodness, we can't have that.
I'm going to piggyback on that question with my own question here, and that's, you know, you're sort of like my bridge to UFO history. You've seen this whole thing evolve over the last 40 years plus.
50.
There you go. Okay. Sorry about that. in the last few years, you know, I've only been in this for 10 years, and in the last few years, I've definitely seen sort of the interdimensional hypothesis gain ground. Has it always, and you know, we kind of know how this disclosure thing sort of had its ebbs and flows. Is it that same way with the interdimensional theory, or is this a relatively sort of new development in UFO thought?
Well, I think it's a relatively new development. I think, you know, interdimensional is great for science fiction writers. That's been a theme for a long time. You know, even think of the Invisible Man as sort of along those lines. And I still don't have much place for it. That doesn't mean I'm ruling it out. But when you got real solid three-dimensional things that leave marks on the ground and grab people and show up on radar and all the rest of that, yes, it would be nice if you could find a way to pop in and out. Wouldn't that be the greatest, boy? But it isn't necessary to explain what's going on. It's an easy way out. Well, we don't have to worry about how they get here. They just pop here, you know, interdimensional. You warp space and time. And I get a kick out of the theoretical cosmologist, who are quite happy to talk about string theory and 11 dimensions of space. And somehow you wiggle those around and you can pop from there to here without any energy. You know, it's very easy to do. I think it's a cop-out, frankly. So I'm not saying we won't find how to do that, and we are doing some mysterious things about particles from here and there kind of thing. But why don't we deal, we've got a three-dimensional world. You know, these things show up on radar, they show up on cameras, they make marks on the ground. What more do you want?
Yeah.
I mean, it's tough enough to deal with those things without worrying about the warping space and time.
Right, right. Well, it reminds me of a conversation I had with Lauren Coleman about Bigfoot. Bigfoot's sort of assailed by the interdimensional hypothesis that's come up in recent years, too. And I can't recall, maybe John Keel or Charles Fort, but he said, you know, you can't really answer an unknown with another unknown. So the interdimensional part, we're just getting further down the rabbit hole of things we don't quite understand.
That's right.
So.
That's right. I don't have a lot of faith in anything John Keel says. I had some dealings with him, and in one letter he had four flat-out wrong comments that he made. So.
That's disappointing. Oh, that's too
bad. I was disappointed.
Bobtimus Prime wants to know if you could share the things that have caught your interest over the last 5 years in ufology / paranormal, and then he puts events, books, movies, ideas. Is there anything you're excited about or find intriguing?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm intrigued as much by some of the science that's gone on and the the Large Hadron Collider and stuff like that. Man gets closer, and this a particle here influencing what's going on with a particle over there, which is kind of weird. That intrigues me. I'm also, how shall I put this? I'm disappointed by the fact that there haven't been more PhD theses done about UFOs, that the lack of curiosity on the part of the so-called scientific community, I would have thought that they would have guts enough to get involved. But that doesn't seem to be the case. And their timidity surprises me. I'm disappointed in that. But I haven't, you know, I haven't found any things that are really totally shocking on the part of the aliens, as far as I can tell. The government sometimes makes me wonder a little bit. But, you know, people say, why would they continue to lie? There's another project, incidentally. I've written the foreword to the two volumes of the Roswell Report. You know, that huge one,
yeah.
Truth versus Fiction in the New Mexico Desert, and the Air Force supplied the fiction, and then the other one, case closed, with the craziest explanation, you know, crash test dummies, which weren't dropped until 6 years. There's time travel for you. Until 6 years after Roswell, after all. My publisher is Cosimo Books is publishing these, and I wrote the foreword for the two new volumes. So I'm intrigued with that. I don't know how people are going to go down that pipe. You know, it's I will be surprised on occasion, and I would hope. I mean, I hate to see all those trees cut down for those books, but what the heck? well, you know, the lack of sensibility in some of the comments that have been made is striking to me about Roswell, about UFOs in general, and I say so in the foreword. I don't think any of these books have had forewords where somebody tears into the government.
The next question comes from David G. And it's a bit of a, I was kind of disappointed in this question, but you have a thicker skin than I do, so I'll read it, I'll read it here. He asks, do you think there might be a time when you might bow out of the insanity of the UFO field and write a real book about real topics that might make you some money? I presume that's real money.
Well, I've talked about writing another book, And there are some intriguing abduction cases that are worthy of fuller attention. But I didn't get into this to make some real money. And, you know, I don't get paid nearly as much as the noisiest negativist did. But my goal has been to support my family. And so the books are icing on the cake. Sure, it's nice to get recognition and all that sort of stuff. And I just gave another college lecture, and I'm giving another one. I used to do them all the time. But bowing out, hey, I'm 78 years old. You want me to start a new career at 78? I mean, come on.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. Well, I take issue here with the statement, write a real book about real topics. I mean, I'm as hard on the UFO field as anybody, but it's a real topic, and your books are real books. I don't know where he gets that.
I'm not ashamed at all of flying saucers and science. A lot of references, a lot. I deal with all the tough aspects. I take on people like Isaac Asimov and Ben Bova and Arthur C. Clarke and Carl Sagan and, you know, the noisy negativists. And I'm not ashamed of those books at all.
Exactly.
And I get good comments about them still.
Oh, Flying Saucers and Science is outstanding. I've actually given it as a gift to several people to try and smarten them up. So, and I
good idea.
I do. I recommend that to everybody out there, especially nowadays with the holiday season. So, perfect gift for your...
They're listed on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com.
There you go. Next email or next question comes from Thomas C. He wants to know your thoughts on the Mars rover program, Curiosity Science Lab in particular. Is it a good choice of tools? And he asks about the current state on NASA's future, he wants to know. So the future of human space exploration, additionally now that the private sector is sort of a space race going on in the private sector.
Well, I'm all for the private sector getting involved. I've often said, quite frankly, because I was in the space program back in the 60s, I've often said that what's missing from NASA is guts, leadership. They needed an Admiral Rickover, and they didn't have one. And for people who don't know who he was responsible for the nuclear navy, in spite of the battleship guys who said, what do you want to build a submarine for? Give us a bigger battleship. We had nuclear submarines in 1956, and we have nuclear aircraft carriers that can go around the world. I mean, well, they can operate for 18 years without refueling. That's a huge step forward.
Yeah.
And so they had a goal, and Rickover's approach was, you don't want to go there? Get off the ship. I'll get some people who do. So I think NASA has been chicken. The worst meeting I ever sat on in my life, and I had a lot of them when I was in industry, at Aerojet General, I was visiting there, and I worked for Westinghouse on the nuclear rocket program. They run the nuclear rocket program. And my contact said, hey, Stan, you want to go to a NASA meeting here? What's it about? Oh, what should we do with the nuclear rocket? Yeah, I want to go to that. Well, shilly-shallying, we could do this. We could put a base on the moon. We could go to Mars, but I don't know if the public... There wasn't the slightest bit of, this is what we want to do, folks. Let's get behind it and do it.
Yeah.
No guts. And so I'm not impressed with NASA, and I am impressed with people who say, look, I'm in business to make money. That means I got to sell stuff. I got to get income. That means I got to do something, not just talk about doing something. And, you know, capitalism is the right to fail. Look how many computer companies that used to be and aren't anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
So NASA doesn't seem to be the right one, at least based on their past history. And the programs I worked on, I was not impressed with NASA. I'm impressed with the space program. Don't misunderstand me. I've known several astronauts, and I'm very impressed. Well, as a matter of fact, one of the forewords to my book, Flying Saucers and Science, was Edgar Mitchell, a sixth man to walk on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And I've met several other astronauts. But I think I'd like to see private industry get much more involved. I mean, you know, the way things are, if the government was in charge of building computers, they'd be 10 years behind where we are now, and they'd cost three times as much, I think.
Yeah.
And so I'm all for private industry getting involved.
You must have seen that article that came out a few days ago, the company that's going to do the private trips to the moon by 2020.
I just caught a headline. I didn't see the article.
The price for a seat is $750 million. So.
Well, it's going to come down.
I hope so. It's like those HD TVs.
I'm all for it. I mean, you know, I know Bob Bigelow. And he's got projects going on up there, and hotels in space, and one has to be realistic about what people want to spend their money on, and who's going to buy this kind of stuff. And he did ask, I was asked there about Curiosity. I'm very impressed by the technology. I mean, the way that thing landed, my goodness, what an incredible...
Oh, yeah.
You know, very impressive. Gutsy. But I wish NASA would open up the box on flying saucers. I mean, you want to be impressed. Let's look at the aliens that are coming here in vehicles that we can't duplicate. That's impressive to me.
Well, he has also a sort of piggyback question that I'll sort of take up here and pose to you. And that's, I'm going to twist it a little bit, but he asks if you expect a renewal in interest in nuclear propulsion relative to Mars and beyond exploration. And I'm going to sort of twist it a little bit and just ask, are you surprised that these private companies haven't turned to the nuclear propulsion concept? Or is it because of the whole, you know, I guess you could say cultural baggage attached to nuclear power?
There is cultural baggage, unfortunately, and Fukushima didn't help any.
Hmm.
But I must say, I was on a panel in near Cape Kennedy, as a matter of fact, and there was a NASA guy on a panel, and this goes back, 10 years anyway. We're talking about using nuclear upper stages to go to Mars, which is what it's intended for, the fission systems. And I said, well, you're only about 30 years late. You know, we had successes back in the 60s, for goodness sakes. So, and you know, one of the remarkable things about the Apollo program is we had a goal, And it felt like a national goal, and all Americans took pride in that. And you know what? We didn't stop because three guys died in a fire, did we?
No.
And we didn't stop when other things happened. That's the price of progress. You know, there's going to be some things that go wrong. You learn from them. You don't say, oh, gee, I better not do it.
Exactly.
It's dangerous. You know, Columbus had guts. He didn't know whether he'd fall off at the other end or not.
Yeah. Next question comes from James C. He wants to know if it's true that there was a Harvard University-led geological expedition in late June or early July in Roswell, New Mexico, in 1947. He thinks he heard you comment on this once.
A Harvard-led geological expedition. Well, there's no question that there were geologists monkeying around in New Mexico. You know, after the war, there was money available for some research. But, and I think he's talking, I wish I could remember the guy's name. Very simple name, very straightforward name. And there were groups down there. They weren't looking for UFOs, incidentally. They were looking for, New Mexico has a lot of signs that there'd been old civilizations there. So naturally, if you want to do a PhD thesis, the guys with the GI Bills, you know, and come out of the service, Herb Dick, that was his name, from Harvard.
Hmm.
There were anthropological more than geological, really. And there were guys up in Clovis, New Mexico. There were a lot of anthropologists, as they say, in New Mexico. They weren't chasing flying saucers, though.
Okay. All right, next question comes from Mark. He says, if Roswell really did happen and we were able to back engineer some alien technology and then integrated that technology into our military systems, then why are we surprised that they are able to shut down our missiles or turn off the systems in our fighter jets? If we're using their technology, they have a better grasp of it, he says.
Well, there's a difference between learning something about a craft. As an example I used to use, you send small pieces of the wreckage, and it wasn't small pieces on the Foster Ranch there, out to your top labs with high-level security clearances, and you say, what is this stuff?
Yeah.
You don't tell them where you got it. And they come back, and somebody says, oh, it's a combination of samarium and cobalt. Why would you put those together? Well, that's somebody else's problem. You send it out to other people. Okay, what are the electrical, magnetic, thermal properties of this stuff? And the guy comes back and says, you know, I don't know what this stuff is or where you got it, but it's got the highest magnetic moment of any material I've ever measured. Make great magnets for ghetto blasters. And that's what those were made out of, was a combination of samarium and cobalt. Well, I used to use it as an example, and then I did a weekly science commentary for CBC Radio here in Fredericton, New Brunswick. And I'm reading an article about new and better permanent magnets and neodymium iron boron. Those are real now. And toward the end of the article, it says the original work on samarium cobalt was done at Wright Air Development Center. And I just burst out laughing. That's at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Yeah, yeah.
So you've learned something. It doesn't mean you've been able to reconstruct the entire vehicle, but you've learned something new and useful.
Hmm.
So another example, in one of my books, there's a picture of me with my hand on the Apollo 12 command module. Big, round, blunt body. But I thought a high-speed aircraft in the atmosphere is supposed to have pointy nose, sharp wings, highly streamlined, you know, like the X-15. But we go to the moon, comes back at 25,000 miles an hour, it's a big, round, blunt body. It wouldn't surprise me at all. Because I know that they did wind tunnel tests at the end of 1947 at Wright Pat on round blunt bodies, measuring lift drag and all that sort of stuff. So it may very well be that the inspiration for that was the flying saucer. Because what I've learned in industry is that the best guarantee of success in what you're in something new that you're trying to do is to know that what you're trying to do can be done.
Right.
The Russians, for example, after the war, knew that you could make nuclear bombs. The United States did. Now, Hitler, on the other hand, didn't know. So he didn't want to spend much of his money on something that might not come around soon enough to help him win the war.
Yeah.
And so these are things that influence what goes on. So I don't think we have fully integrated alien technology. People just don't understand how complicated things are. I mean, give Christopher Columbus a nuclear submarine and an unlimited budget. Chris, I need two more of these. Could he have built one? Not a chance.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. Scott C. says, or asks, being a nuclear physicist, you must have some ideas about possible engines or fuel sources for these craft. Presumably he means UFOs.
Well, okay, we got two different problems. One is, how do you get from star A to star B, where star B is the sun? And the other is, once you're here, how do you zip around in the atmosphere where you've got high temperatures and pressures and all kinds of things, where between the stars you ain't got nothing, man. And I think for the deep space problem, nuclear fusion is a good solution. As I say, I worked on studies of it. It'll work.
Yeah.
Just it's going to take a lot of dough. Within the atmosphere, and I said this in my congressional testimony, which is on the internet, 1968, July 29th, my birthday, incidentally. That's not why they held the hearings those days. And there is talk of another set of hearings Steve Bassett is talking about. I've been invited to participate in 5 days before a simulated congressional hearing with 5 ex-congressmen listening to 40 witnesses in 5 days and stuff like that. But anyway, within the atmosphere, I like magneto-aerodynamics. In 1970, I had a literature search when I was briefly working for McDonnell Douglas before the program was canceled. And I used one word, magneto-aerodynamics, for a literature search of the technical report literature. This is not the open scientific literature, but when you got a government study, you got to write a report. Anyway, I got 900 references, 90% of which were classified.
Oh, wow.
Using the word magneto-aerodynamics. So somebody was doing a lot of work in that area. So I think within the atmosphere, and people are aware of this in a rough way. When a meteor comes in or when an Apollo comes back, you heat the air, it glows, that ionized air plasma interact with electric and magnetic fields, and you can control lift, drag, heating, all the good things, and get silent propulsion and all that sort of stuff. So that's as a first cut. Would it be easy? No, of course it wouldn't be easy. You know, trying to build a microcircuit 20 years ago wouldn't have been easy.
All right, Corey T. is the next questioner, and he sets it up first by saying there's no doubt that popular culture can introduce concepts and ideas into our minds directly and indirectly, especially through the power of entertainment. I often wonder about the evolution of movies and literature throughout the 50s and 60s and whether or not collectively, if they created the atypical type of abduction experience, perhaps at the subconscious level. And then here's the question for you, which I think you actually already answered earlier here. He says, though I feel certain that Betty and Barney Hill experienced something major, has anyone ever researched perhaps their own backgrounds regarding exposure to pop culture of the time?
Well, yeah, this is discussed and captured. They had other things on their mind. They were very active in the community. Barney was on a governor's civil rights commission. They're active in church studies. Betty was a social worker, after all. And as a matter of fact, they took Kathleen Martin, who did most of the work on Captured, to the inauguration of Lyndon Johnson in 1964. They had an invitation. And so I think they really were abducted. The star map is an indication of that. And Dr. Benjamin Simon, the psychiatrist who did the hypnosis work, one of the world's experts on treatment of, shell shock, but post-traumatic stress disorder, sounds much more sophisticated, same thing. He said that the emotional intensity, as they relived these experiences, was equally as strong as that of any of the thousands of war veterans he worked with. He ran a hospital for 3,000 beds for guys who came back from the Second World War, shell shock, PTSD. And coming from him, he had to stop one session each because he wasn't sure they could handle it. In other words, heartbeat going up like crazy.
Yeah,
terror, real terror. So I think his comments, he didn't know a damn thing about flying saucers. But that wasn't the point. He was to help them uncover the mystery of the missing time. What happened? And separately, and he used his well-known techniques. As a matter of fact, the Army had a movie made, Let There Be Light, starring Dr. Simon, showing how he brought, you know, your guy's buddy's head's been blown off next to him. That's a little hard to integrate into normal life.
Right, right.
You know, so they couldn't have had anybody better than Dr. Simon. And that's what makes the difference about that case compared to so many others. He didn't put any words in their minds. He knew what he was doing.
Right, right. I think it's been pretty fairly discredited, the idea that they were influenced by pop culture to have these stories happen. So
not at all. They didn't want it. They, this business of Barney watching a science fiction movie on television, forget it.
Well, the ironic part is if you really sort of apply Occam's razor to the whole thing, if that argument held water, then they wouldn't be the only people having these experiences. There would have been a rash of sort of this story going on before. You know what I mean?
Yeah, inspiration by science fiction, yeah.
Right. And that didn't happen, so it stands to reason that that couldn't be the case.
Right. Good thinking.
The next question comes from Carl D., who says, it seems like the same old UFO stories are rehashed again and again in both favorable and unfavorable documentaries. But I have heard Stan say that there are something like 3,000 pieces or 3,000 cases with physical evidence. It was on Larry King, I think, when Michael Shermer was there, too. Anyway, he says, can Stan review some of the best physical evidence cases and speculate as to why they aren't covered more often, and exactly what evidence mainstream academic science would accept as proof or, quote, really good evidence, unquote, short of the UFO on the White House lawn?
Well, the reason is very simple. Ted Phillips hasn't written his book yet. Ted's been collecting physical trace case data for more than 40 years. He was a protege of Alan Hynek. And at one time, he had as many as, 4,000 cases. It went up from the day I said that on King. 4,000 cases from, 80 countries. These are cases where people see something on or near the ground, and after it leaves, one finds physical changes, the equivalent of burn circles, burn rings, landing gear marks, footprints in some cases. 1/6 of those cases involve reports of beings, creatures, whatever you want to call them, associated with the craft. And, you know, I hate to say this, but after you read your first 200 cases, it's dull. The same thing is happening all over the world. And so I actually had some of the first tests run on the soil where there was one of these circles in Delphos, Kansas. And there's no question that the area of the circle, lifesaver shaped, about 10 feet in outer diameter, about a foot across, down 14 inches, that soil was changed. It was dried out. And good lab tests showed it had a higher level of soluble minerals. It was too salty to grow anything, and it wouldn't grow anything. But Ted never did write his book. I wish it could be written. Because, as I say, there's so much of that stuff. And when you get similar reports from all over the world, what are you going to do? Everybody's crazy in the same kind of way? The creatures look the same. Now, these were not the mothership cases. They don't usually seem to land on the ground.
Yeah.
But when you get cases like the Japan Airlines case, this thing twice the size of an aircraft carrier circling around a 747, seen by the guys out the window and by their radar, and they radio the ground, and the ground radar sees them and the other object. It was a big old thing. And the Yukon case, between 0.6 and 1.2 miles long, 30-some witnesses that Martin Jasek collected. And, again, when you get multiple independent people describing the same things, and where you have a careful researcher, and Martin Jasek was a civil engineer. That's why I was able to triangulate the thing. He took great attention and care, and yes, I've met him and been in his home and so forth. Very impressive. So these physical cases, if they were put into a book, I think would be extraordinarily convincing. Now, they're not spectacular in the sense nobody's talking about aliens dancing at a graveyard or, you know, it doesn't have that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But there is an enormous amount of evidence. Yes, I did say that and I stick by it.
Okay, and just to follow up a little bit on his question here, he says, you know, what exactly what evidence would be enough is kind of what he's saying. It does seem difficult. I mean, what would finally get us over the hump? It would have to be an alien or a UFO, a solid UFO, right?
Well, or the government releasing
right.
a bunch of data.
Yeah.
And it's got plenty of it. And the thing is, if you have groups like NARCAP, National Advisory Commission on Atmospheric Aircraft Phenomena, anomalistic aircraft, I forget what NARCAP stands for, but they've collected, it's run by pilots, and Dr. Richard Haynes, who worked for NASA, incidentally, retired now, as their chief scientist, if you will. They have well over 1,000 reports from pilots who don't want their names used, I might add, for obvious reasons. Because many of them felt they'd lose their jobs, or they have buddies who were sent for psychological testing. That's enough to discourage the other guys, you know.
Yeah.
And so there's their report should be adequate for anybody. I mean, there are an awful lot of things that we accept without having the body in the front yard kind of thing.
Exactly.
Look at all the testimony in criminal cases. You know, sometimes you have fingerprints, but you usually don't have the finger when it comes to aliens with the footprints and so forth.
There you go. All right, we're in the final four questions now, so we're real close. Scott C. Asks or makes the point here, with the ever-increasing commonality of UFO information via television shows, movies, radio, and online, is it possible that the subject has become sterile at this point, due to how much the masses hear about the subject, thereby making it less significant in the same way people are numb to political and religious thinking?
Well, it's certainly possible, and that's why I mentioned at the beginning the book The Alien Abduction Files by Kathleen Martin and Denise Stoner from Career Press should be out in a few months. It's a different approach to the abduction phenomena and gets away from the standard fare, if you will. And I hope that will encourage other people. What I've found, incidentally, that there's an old notion. New ideas, Max Planck said this, great physicist 100 years ago, new ideas come to be accepted not because their opponents come to believe in them, but because their opponents die and a new generation grows up that's accustomed to them.
Yes.
And I detect a lot of people being accustomed to the idea of flying saucers and alien visitors. Part of that is Kepler. I mean, when suddenly we're talking, instead of Frank Drake's 8,000 planets maybe in the galaxy, so maybe it's 8 billion. That changes the
whole
picture. And so I think it's coming to be accepted more. Despite the Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal, you know, it's only kooks see UFOs. I mean, that really is pretty silly. And so I'm an optimist. I think things are going to be better. This book should be an important part of that. And I think you're going to get some physical scientists who may decide that, you know, it's time to do things right. And forget all the SETI stuff. SETI stands for Silly Effort to Investigate. You know, that's my interpretation anyway. And I mean that sincerely. It's not that these are bad people, but they sure haven't looked at the relevant evidence, and they don't dare to.
Exactly. All right, next question comes from Marco, and he actually has two questions. It reminds me of back when we used to do the Exeter shows. I would host the Q&A at the end of the evening and say, when the line would form, you have to just have one question, folks. You just have to have one question because we have limited time. Then the first person in line would immediately say, hi, thank you. I have two questions. So This is Marco has fulfilled the UFO enthusiast quota there. So he has two questions, but they're pretty simple, and both of them were very intriguing to me. So we'll break the rules and do that for him. He says there was a rumor back in 67 on the Long John Neville show that Frank Edwards may have been assassinated. A local and longtime researcher and close friend of Edwards, Earl Neff, now deceased, took a cursory look into it and couldn't verify anything. Have you heard of this?
Well, I did know Frank Edwards, and it was because of his book, Flying Saucer Serious Business, that I went public. I asked him for names of some people, time to speak out. He gave me the name of a producer in Pittsburgh of the Contact radio show. Would you believe that? And I called them. They weren't particularly interested. I was working for Westinghouse. I thought they would be, but they called me then a month later. Could you be on tonight? This is at 6:30 to be on a 7 o'clock show. I live near the station. And that was my first show, KDKA Pittsburgh, and I went on from there. And that was because of Frank, and I introduced him when he spoke in Pittsburgh. And I knew Earl Neff, too, from Cleveland. And I actually, this will sound a little strange, but I did talk to Frank's wife after his death. I also talked to Jim McDonald's wife and daughter after his death. Because there were rumors flying around. And so I wanted to make sure, you know, how did they feel about that,
right.
These people. And Frank went to bed. He was very tired, he told her, and he never woke up. I'm satisfied it was a natural death. And with McDonald, it was suicide. And I talked to his daughter about that. I normally wouldn't ask, but people were coming up with all kinds of rumors like the ones you just mentioned.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
I had to find out from the source. Not what I read in some newspaper. I talked to McDonald's office mate at the university and his daughter and his wife. Now, how much more can I do than that, you know? So with Frank, no, I don't see any reason to think that there was a conspiracy, a death, a murder, whatever you want to call it, no.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. Well, some things never change because, you know, Mac Toney's passed away a few years ago, and there's all kinds of people who insist that he was taken out or something. And you know, Paul Kimball and Greg Bishop, and they know Mac's family, and they know that that's not true. So it's a frustrating sort of thing, but people have to go the sensational route. The other question Marco had, he says, I had the opportunity to talk with Betty Hill on the phone sometime back in the mid-70s. At the time, she said she was putting together a picture book of sorts on UFOs. As we were speaking, she said she was having a security system installed or the locks changed because someone had broken into her home and had stolen her photos. Do you know if she ever completed the book? He's never seen it anywhere.
Betty did publish a book in her own words, and Kathleen Martin, my co-author on two books, still has a few copies of that, and Kathleen is on the internet. She's got a website. Look her up, KathleenMardin. You'll get her website and probably list that book. So she did write a book, and there were some break-ins there. We never did know what a couple of them meant. You had the feeling the aliens had come in.
Yeah, I remember the earrings.
Left some stuff behind, and, you know, how did it get there and so forth. So,
the earrings, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
We talked
right
about that on a previous show. Yeah, that's a terrifying story. We're on the second to last question here. Mark L. asks, most people that claim they are abducted talk about seeing aliens. Very rarely do they talk about aliens wearing any type of breathing apparatus. How is it that they are able to breathe our atmosphere so easily? He makes the analogy of climbing a mountain, how the air gets thinner. Are you, Stan, aware of any other cases other than Travis Walton that talks about difficulty breathing while being abducted? And what are your thoughts on aliens being so similar to us that they can breathe our atmosphere so easily? It's an interesting question.
Well, we don't know that they may not be acclimatized. You know, you got to take a 3-month course in breathing Earth's atmosphere. But, I look at it the other way around. I think the ammonia breathers go to Jupiter for their vacations. What can I say? The grad students, you know, doing their thing. I think there's a kind of commonality. It wouldn't surprise me at all if Earthlings are the result of previous colonization, migration, whatever, and that there may be other forms of life. On the other hand, there are some good analyses showing that Humans seem to be a kind of sensible design. You know, you need the head at the top of the body so you can see your enemies. You need some kind of a device for grasping things so you can manipulate stuff. You know, two eyes is fine. You don't need three. Two ears, you can get a direction from stuff you hear and stuff like that. So I think we may be the result of colonization, migration. One thought is that we're the devil's island of this corner of the galaxy. They dumped all the bad boys and girls here. That's why we're so nasty to each other. That's as good an explanation as I know. I mean, how can a planet justify spending $1 trillion a year on things military when literally thousands of children die every single day of preventable disease or starvation? That tells you a lot about us. Primitive society, major activity, tribal warfare. And so I that's a better explanation than some I can think of as to why we're so evil to each other. And I got the shock of my life. Gal from New York, worked for CBS, had a college degree. She was in her 30s. This is several years ago. She came up to talk to me. We went to lunch. And afterward, I'm telling her about why aliens would come here, because at the end of the war, it was clear pretty soon we'd be moving out and we're a threat to the neighborhood. I said, after all, we killed 50 million people in the war and destroyed 1,700 cities. And before I could finish, she said, oh, I don't believe that. What don't you believe? Well, I don't think we killed 50 million people. Well, how many do you think got killed during World War II? Only 3 or 4 million. That answer scared the heck out of me.
Yeah.
Because if you don't realize how evil man can be, he will do it again. I mean, 6 million in the Holocaust, a whole bunch of Russians and Chinese and Japanese and all kinds of other people. So, you know, the concept is a little weird. And I should add one other thing, you know, the Australians are very proud of their convict ancestors. Honest. The English debtor prisons were emptied. They dumped them down in Australia. So what I'm saying is we got to go with what we got. Like I say, ammonia breathers go to Jupiter that way.
Exactly.
Not here.
All right. The final question comes from Dan F., who asks, do you know if any U.S. government agencies are currently investigating UFOs? If so, which agencies, and how did you find out this information? FOI requests. I hate to laugh, but it seems sort of an oddball. Personal contacts or other sources.
I think there's no question. If you go back to General Bolander, there are procedures set up for dealing with the reports which could affect national security. And all of those are owned by the government. In other words, the pilots in high-performance aircraft, the guys running the NRO, National Reconnaissance Office, spy satellites, all those other things, I'm sure they got plenty of data, and that there's the equivalent of a Majestic 12, if you will. Do I have any straight statement from the government saying so? Of course not. That would be classified. But if they read my book, Top Secret Magic, they'll see I do make a strong case for 3 genuine MJ-12 documents, Majestic 12, Magic 12. And, oh, I didn't mention there's going to be a movie, Magic Men, M-A-J-I-C.
Yes.
My book and Don Schmidt and Tom Carey's book, Witness to Roswell, and put them together. That'll be one book, you know, sort of like JFK and All the President's Men. And I want Richard Dreyfuss to play me, of course. and there will the same guys, Bryce Zabel, Stellar Productions, they have also bought the film rights and to capture the Betty and Barney Hill UFO experience. And the screenplay has already been rewritten 4 times, so we're almost getting there for Magic Men. So I might live long enough to see 2 of my books converted into movies.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, that wraps up the listener questions. I had one more question here for you that I had myself that I thought of over the course of this conversation and previously leading into this, and that's just that, you know, we've discussed your background at length here in the many conversations we've had, and, you know, how you had you got an extra book, and that's what sort of spawned the whole interest in UFOs. And I'm sure many other people of that time and of your scientific acumen took a look at that book too. I mean, why do you think that you kept going with it? You know, why didn't you just read it, say, oh, that's interesting, and then just, you know, put it away? What spawned you to dive into this?
A couple of things. One, it's a natural match for my strong points. I'm a Leo. I enjoy being on the stage. I was in high school debating, and I found that I really enjoy performing, if you will. Secondly, I worked on classified programs, so I can deal with those questions. Governments can't cover things up.
Right.
Well, yes, they can. Third, I worked in advanced technology, so I see answers to the questions. Can you get here from there? Can you move like this or that?
Hmm.
And fourth, what I found is that people are really interested in the why questions. Data I present, they don't quarrel with it because I show them facts, information, tables from reports, all that sort of thing. But they really want to know, so why would aliens come here? Why doesn't the government tell us what it knows? Why don't they land on the White House lawn? And all these kinds of questions. And because I've heard them all before, of course, I have answers ready. And the usual response is, gee, I hadn't thought of that before. I should add, I've only had 11 hecklers out of over 700 lectures, and two of them were drunk. And you'd get more than that if you talk about sports, religion, or politics, I am assured. I don't talk about those things. So I have loved the response I've gotten. I'm a ham. Not kosher, but I'm a ham. And I enjoy the feedback, what people say at the end of my lectures and after they've heard me on radio or television or whatever. So I've kept at it because it's a natural fit with my proclivities, if you will. And I worried when I got started that somebody's going to smash it all with stuff that I don't know anything about. Never happened. So people say, when are you going to retire, Stan? I said, why should I retire? I like what I'm doing. I like my boss. That's me. You know, as long as I'm healthy. Now, that's the one kicker, of course. But mm-hmm. I've been very lucky. I have never spent overnight in a hospital for me.
Excellent.
Not many people at age 78 can say that. So
that's true. Now, just to piggyback on that final question, I remember talking to George Knapp a few years ago, and he was saying how, you know, when he first started looking into this, he was like, well, I'll get to the bottom of this in short order. And then,
sure.
You know, you've been doing this for 50 years. Are you surprised that it's taken so long and we still haven't made it to the conclusion of this story?
No, I'm not, because as I tell people, this is the biggest story of the millennium. Four major conclusions. First, Earth is being visited by extraterrestrial spacecraft. Some UFOs are alien spacecraft. Second, we're dealing with a cosmic Watergate. Some few people in government know a lot about the subject and aren't telling us. Third, we're dealing with, there are no good arguments against those first two conclusions. And fourth, we're dealing with the biggest story of the millennium. I say two millennia, then I run into religious problems. I don't need those. So it's a natural fit. I would never have predicted this if you'd asked me in 1964, you know, what I was going to be. You're going to spend full time as a ufologist? What are you, crazy? And, you know, I better add a little story that I don't often tell on the air. People say, why did you choose to do this and get out of industry? And so I was driving across the country to take the ideal job, trying to figure out how saucers work for McDonnell Douglas Astronautics, Dr. Robert Wood. And I was really excited about it. Halfway across the country, the program that was going to be sponsoring my work was canceled. I walked in the door, and she says, you know, we just laid off 5,000 people. I said, yeah, I know that. I had to support my family, so they kept me on for 3 months. The rest is, let's work your butt off to get lectures, and I did, and very well received, so let's do it. But it was not a conscious choice. Oh, I want to be a ufologist, the heck with this industrial science kind of stuff. Not at all.
Yeah, you said that in the past. The bottom fell out of the nuclear work. So, well, you know something, we're richer for it in the field, so... You know, as luck would have it. Now that wraps up the annual conversation here. What's coming up for you in 2013, provided we make it through the end of the Mayan calendar?
Well, if we don't, we won't know about it.
Yeah.
I'm going to be at Roswell again. I'm speaking. I've got several lectures coming up in Texas and Utica, New York. They'll be on my website. I got to update it. You know, we're going to go at, the International UFO Congress in Phoenix, the end of February to March. So I'll still be doing what I've been doing, and check out the website, and they'll find out.
Excellent, excellent. How about now? You said you got the foreword for that new abduction book, which is great because abduction needs a shot in the arm. So I'm hoping that that'll do that for it because it's really had some bad years in the last few years. So beyond the introduction for that, any future books you got working on or considering or anything like that? I'm going to make my annual push for the memoir. So please do that.
Yeah, I may have to do that because that deal with the movie includes memoirs and personal history and stuff like that, so it may force me to finally sit down and do what needs to be done.
Absolutely, so please do that. Well, on that note, Stan, I can't thank you enough. As I said, this is really getting choked up here. I mean, you're the first guy I ever interviewed, so... And it's been 200 plus since then, and to know that 8 of them have been you every year for the holiday special is just so humbling, and it's a thrill for me that you've become such a part of this program. So
it's my pleasure indeed. I enjoy it. You know something. Some interviewers don't know much.
Are you saying I'm the exception to the rule there?
Yes.
Well, thank you very much, and happy holidays to you and to all the listeners, and thank you for their questions, and thank you once again for being a part of the holiday tradition, my friend.
Happy 2013.
There you go. Be well.
You too. Bye-bye.
That does it for the 8th annual BOA Audio Holiday Special featuring Stanton Friedman. Big, big thanks once again to the legendary Stan Friedman for returning to the program and taking part in this year's festivities. If you have not done so yet, please check out the website, www.stantonfriedman.com, and get the books by Stanton Friedman. They are must-own tomes for any serious student of ufology. Moving right along now, it's time for BOA Audio Listener Feedback, but it is December 24th, I'm looking at the clock, it is 12 noon on Christmas Eve, and if I do not get my sleigh in gear, this program will arrive sometime after Santa Claus, so we will skip listener feedback, plus we featured 20 questions from BOA Audio listeners here on the program, kind of an impromptu freed back, if you will. Pardon the pun. But a lot of listener feedback already here on the program for Stanton Friedman. So we can skip listener feedback here this week. And of course, I really just want to take a moment once again to wish everybody a very Merry Christmas and an awesome holiday season. Chances are you'll be hearing from me after the new year. So I hope you all have a very safe and joyous New Year as well. Be safe out there, folks. I can't stress that one enough. A lot of maniacs on the road on New Year's Eve. I know I skipped listener feedback at the end of the program last week, so 1,000 apologies here for skipping it once again. Let's just tag this as my 2013 New Year's resolution to really feature more consistent BOA Audio listener feedback at the end of the program. And on that note, let me give you the means to contact me if you'd like to be a part of future installments of BOA Audio listener feedback. You can write to boaaudio@hotmail.com, or you can head on over to banalofamerica.com, B-I-N-N-A-L-L ofamerica.com, and click the contact button. If you'd like something a little more interactive, you can join up at the official BOA forum, theusofe.com, theusofe.com. You can also find that by clicking the forum button at BOA. It is Banal of America's paranormal playground, theusofe.com. Lots of great conversation going on there regarding the world of the paranormal as well as pop culture. As far as social networks go, of course, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. Just punch in Binall, B-I-N-N-A-L-L, and my profile will pop right up.
Feel free to befriend me, follow me, or poke me. It's all good, and I'd be happy to have you as part of my online circle of friends. And finally, there is Banal of America on Facebook. I think since the last time you've heard from me, we've reached 867 people. So we're within relative striking distance of the big 1,000. And as we did for number 800, whoever makes it to number 900 will get a shout out here at the end of the program. So like us on Facebook, and hopefully we'll reach these milestone numbers in the not too distant future. Up next, please allow me to take a moment and thank the outstanding and esteemed BOA staff. Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, Bruce Pretty, Tony Morrill, and our webmaster Jeremy Boston. I hope all of the amazing BOA staff have a fantastic holiday season as well. Thank you for all of your support here in 2012. Now comes the time in the program where I ring a little bell and ask you to put some change in the bucket for Banal of America. I'd like to tell you all that we have some awesome holiday deals at BOA, but that would not be true, my friends, because all 200-plus episodes of the program are and always have been absolutely free for the BOA audio listeners. With that said, such an undertaking, of course, costs us money. So if you could help us out and make a donation to Banal of America, it would be greatly appreciated. How do you do that? That's simple. There are two ways to help us out. You can head on over to Banal of America and click the PayPal button. That'll take you to PayPal. They'll walk you through the process. It's safe, secure, and simple. But what if you don't trust the internet? What if you want to send us something via snail mail? Well, you're in luck because we have a Banal of America P.O. Box. And the address for that is Tim Banal, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass. 01866. And you spell Pinehurst, P-I-N-E-H-U-R-S-T. The complete address can be found at Banal of America, and if you send us something, please make any donations payable to Tim Banal and not Banal of America, since my bank is anal and will not honor those donations, and please include some form of correspondence so I can reach out to you and thank you for your help. As always, it bears repeating, my friends, no donation is too small, and all donations go towards Banal of America and BOA Audio to help keep the entire franchise up and running, freely available, and commercial-free for all of our great readers and listeners the world over. Finally, now comes the plug for the next edition of the program. This one's a bit tenuous because I'm really hoping to do our annual ufology/paranormal Year in Review with Greg Bishop as a live program, and I have not actually spoken to Greg yet to set up a date and time for that live program, so it's all very up in the air, and given that it is the holiday season, I have a tremendously jam-packed schedule. I'm sure Greg does as well. We may have to forego doing it as a live program unless we can find an agreeable time for the both of us to sit down and have all of the BOA audio listeners tuning in at the moment. So stay tuned to Banal of America on Facebook and at the website and on the forum for more information on when that live edition of the program may air. If we can't do it live, I'll let you all know, of course, and I will definitely try to get the episode into your earbuds within a week or so of the new year. Beyond that, we plugged here at the end of the show on the last edition of the program. We've got a 3-hour epic with Paul Kimball coming at you right after the new year starts. I'd also like to bring back our old friend Adam Davies for a conversation on his past year in the world of cryptozoology, so I got to reach out to him and touch base about doing that as well. following that, I've got a huge list of new guests that I want to get on the program, one of which I've already recorded an interview with, and it is spectacular. But the rest I'm going to be contacting following the holiday. Trust me, these are some amazing guests and people that I'm very excited to be talking to, and hopefully we can lock them in for BOA audio episodes as 2013 unfolds. As noted, stay tuned to Banal of America on Facebook and all of our various other outlets for further information about upcoming editions of the program. And on that note, we close the book on the 8th annual BOA Audio Holiday Special. Once again, enormous thanks to the incomparable Stanton Friedman for joining us on this year's festivities. Big, big thanks to all the folks who submitted questions for this year's special. And, of course, a hearty, heartfelt thanks and happy holidays to all you folks out there listening right now, the hardcore BOA audio listeners, the folks who stick with me to the very end of the show. I hope you all have a very Merry Christmas and an awesome holiday season. You are the very best, and I truly appreciate all of your support this past year and look forward to a wealth of mind-blowing and enlightening conversations that we can all share in 2013. Once again, thank you for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist, and thank you for making the BOA Audio Holiday Special a part of your December traditions. Until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.